tightened his post office, and shook his head, as if his opinion were dead against any fatal weakness of that sort. "This friend," I pursued, "is trying to get on in commercial life, but has no money, and finds it difficult and disheartening to make a beginning. Now I want somehow to help him to a beginning."
"With money down?"
said Wemmick, in a tone drier than any sawdust. "With some money down," I replied, for an uneasy remembrance shot across me of that symmetrical bundle of papers at home. "With some money down, and perhaps some anticipation of my expectations."
"Mr. Pip," said Wemmick, "I should like just to run over with you on my fingers, if you please, the names of the various bridges up as high as Chelsea Reach. Let's see. There's London, 1, Southwark, 2, Blackfriars, 3, Waterloo, 4, Westminster, 5, Vauxhall, 6.
He had checked off each bridge in its turn with the handle of his safe key on the palm of his hand.
"There's as many as 6, you see, to choose from."
"I don't understand you," said I.
"Choose your bridge, Mr. Pip," returned Wemmick, "and take a walk upon your bridge, and pitch your money into the Thames over the centre arch of your bridge, and you know the end of it. Serve a friend with it, and you may know the end of it too, but it is a less pleasant and profitable end."
I could have posted a newspaper in his mouth, he made it so wide after saying this.
"This is very discouraging," said I. "Meant to be so," said Wemmick.
"Then it is your opinion," I inquired with some little indignation, "that a man should never invest portable property in a friend?"
said Wemmick. "Certainly he should not, unless he wants to get rid of the friend, and then it becomes a question how much portable property it may be worth to get rid of him."
"And that," said I, "is your deliberate opinion, Mr. Wemmick?"
"That," he returned, "is my deliberate opinion in this office."
"Ah," said I, pressing him, for I thought I saw him near a loophole here. "But would that be your opinion at Woolworth?"
"Mr. Pip," he replied with gravity, "Woolworth is one place, and this office is another, much as the aged is one person, and Mr. Jaggers is another. They must not be confounded together. My Woolworth sentiments must be taken at Woolworth. None but my official sentiments can be taken in this office."
"Very well," said I, much relieved. "And then I shall look you up at Woolworth, you may depend upon it."
"Mr. Pip," he returned, "you will be welcome there in a private and personal capacity."
We had held this conversation in a low voice, well knowing my guardian's ears to be the sharpest of the sharp. As he now appeared in his doorway, toweling his hands, Wemmick got on his greatcoat and stood by to snuff out the candles. We all three went into the street together, and from the doorstep Wemmick turned his way, and Mr. Jaggers and I turned ours. I could not help wishing more than once that evening that Mr. Jaggers had had an aged in Gerrard Street, or a stinger, or something, or a somebody, to unbend his brows a little. It was an uncomfortable consideration on a 21st birthday. The coming of age at all seemed hardly worthwhile in such a guarded and suspicious world as he made of it. He was 1,000 times better informed and cleverer than Wemmick, and yet I would 1,000 times rather have had Wemmick to dinner. And Mr. Jaggers made not me alone intensely melancholy, but because, after he was gone, Herbert said of himself, with his eyes fixed on the fire, that he thought he must have committed a felony and forgotten the details of it, he felt so dejected and guilty. Chapter 37. Deeming Sunday the best day for taking Mr. Wemmick's Woolworth sentiments, I devoted the next ensuing Sunday afternoon to a pilgrimage to the castle. On arriving before the battlements, I found the Union Jack flying and the drawbridge up. But undeterred by this show of defiance and resistance, I rang at the gate and was admitted in a most pacific manner by the aged.
"My son, sir," said the old man, after securing the drawbridge, "rather had it in his mind that you might happen to drop in, and he left word that he would soon be home from his afternoon's walk. He's very regular in his walks, is my son. Very regular in everything, is my son."
I nodded at the old gentleman, as Wemmick himself might have nodded, and we went in and sat down by the fireside.
"You made acquaintance with my son, sir?"
said the old man in his chirping way, while he warmed his hands at the blaze.
"At his office, I expect?"
I nodded.
"Ah, I've heard that my son is a wonderful hand at his business, sir."
I nodded hard.
"Yes, so they tell me. His business is the law."
I nodded harder.
"Which makes it more surprising in my son," said the old man. "For he was not brought up to the law, but to the wine-coopering."
Curious to know how the old gentleman stood informed concerning the reputation of Mr. Jaggers, I roared that name at him. He threw me into the greatest confusion by laughing heartily and replying in a very sprightly manner,
"No, to be sure, you're right."
And to this hour I have not the faintest notion what he meant or what joke he thought I had made. As I could not sit there nodding at him perpetually without making some other attempt to interest him, I shouted an inquiry whether his own calling in life had been the wine-coopering. By dint of straining that term out of myself several times and tapping the old gentleman on the chest to associate it with him, I at last succeeded in making my meaning understood.
"No,"
said the old gentleman.
"The warehousing, the warehousing. First, over yonder."
He appeared to mean up the chimney, but I believe he intended to refer me to Liverpool.
"And then in the city of London here. However, having an infirmity, for I'm hard of hearing, sir."
I expressed in pantomime the greatest astonishment.
"Yes, hard of hearing. Having that infirmity coming upon me, my son, he went into the law, and he took charge of me, and he by little and little made out this elegant and beautiful property. But returning to what you said, you know,"
pursued the old man, again laughing heartily,
"what I say is, no, to be sure, you're right."
I was modestly wondering whether my utmost ingenuity would have enabled me to say anything that would have amused him half as much as this imaginary pleasantry, when I was startled by a sudden click in the wall at one side of the chimney, and the ghostly tumbling open of a little wooden flap with John upon it. The old man, following my eyes, cried with great triumph,
"My son's come home!"
And we both went out to the drawbridge. It was worth any money to see Wemmick waving a salute to me from the other side of the moat, when we might have shaken hands across it with the greatest ease. The aged was so delighted to work the drawbridge that I made no offer to assist him, but stood quiet until Wemmick had come across and had presented me to Miss Skiffins, a lady by whom he was accompanied. Miss Skiffins was of a wooden appearance, and was, like her escort, in the post office branch of the service. She might have been some 2 or 3 years younger than Wemmick, and I judged her to stand possessed of portable property. The cut of her dress from the waist upward, both before and behind, made her figure very like a boy's kite, and I might have pronounced her gown a little too decidedly orange, and her gloves a little too intensely green. But she seemed to be a good sort of fellow, and showed a high regard for the aged. I was not long in discovering that she was a frequent visitor at the castle, for on our going in, and my complimenting Wemmick on his ingenious contrivance for announcing himself to the aged, he begged me to give my attention for a moment to the other side of the chimney, and disappeared. Presently another click came, and another little door tumbled open with Miss Skiffins on it. Then Miss Skiffins shut up, and John tumbled open. Then Miss Skiffins and John both tumbled open together, and finally shut up together. On Wemmick's return from working these mechanical appliances, I expressed the great admiration with which I regarded them, and he said, "Well, you know they're both pleasant and useful to the aged. By George, sir, it's a thing worth mentioning that of all the people who come to this gate, the secret of those pools is only known to the aged, Miss Skiffins, and me."
"And Mr. Wemmick made them," added Miss Skivins, "with his own hands, out of his own head."
While Miss Skivins was taking off her bonnet, she retained her green gloves during the evening as an outward and visible sign that there was company. Wemmick invited me to take a walk with him round the property and see how the island looked in winter time. Thinking that he did this to give me an opportunity of taking his Woolworth sentiments, I seized the opportunity as soon as we were out of the castle. Having thought of the matter with care, I approached my subject as if I had never hinted at it before. I informed Wemmick that I was anxious in behalf of Herbert Pocket, and I told him how we had at first met and how we had fought. I glanced at Herbert's home and at his character, and at his having no means but such as he was dependent on his father for, those uncertain and unpunctual. I alluded to the advantages I had derived in my first rawness and ignorance from his society, and I confessed that I feared I had but ill repaid them, and that he might have done better without me and my expectations. Keeping Miss Havisham in the background at a great distance, I still hinted at the possibility of my having competed with him in his prospects, and at the certainty of his possessing a generous soul and being far above any mean distrusts, retaliations, or designs. For all these reasons, I told Wemmick, and because he was my young companion and friend, and I had a great affection for him, I wish my own good fortune to reflect some rays upon him, and therefore I sought advice from Wemmick's experience and knowledge of men and affairs, how I could best try, with my resources, to help Herbert to some present income, say, of 100 a year, to keep him in good hope and heart, and gradually to buy him on to some small partnership. I begged Wemmick, in conclusion, to understand that my help must always be rendered without Herbert's knowledge or suspicion, and that there was no one else in the world with whom I could advise. I wound up by laying my hand upon his shoulder and saying, "I can't help confiding in you, though I know it must be troublesome to you, but that is your fault in having ever brought me here." Wemmick was silent for a little while, and then said with a kind of start,
"Well, you know, Mr. Pip, I must tell you one thing. This is devilish good of you."
"Say you'll help me to be good, then," said I.
"Ecod," replied Wemmick, shaking his head, "that's not my trade."
"Nor is this your trading place," said I.
"You're right," he returned. "You hit the nail on the head, Mr. Pip. I'll put on my considering cap, and I'll think all you want to do may be done by degrees. Skiffins, that's her brother, is an accountant and agent. I'll look him up and go to work for you."
"I thank you 10,000 times.
"On the contrary," said he, "I thank you, for though we are strictly in our private and personal capacity, still it may be mentioned that there are Newgate cobwebs about, and it brushes them away."
After a little further conversation to the same effect, we returned into the castle, where we found Miss Skiffins preparing tea. The responsible duty of making the toast was delegated to the aged, and that excellent old gentleman was so intent upon it that he seemed to be in some danger of melting his eyes. It was no nominal meal that we were going to make, but a vigorous reality. The aged prepared such a haystack of buttered toast that I could scarcely see him over it as it simmered on an iron stand hooked onto the top bar, while Miss Skiffins brewed such a jorum of tea that the pig in the back premises became strongly excited and repeatedly expressed his desire to participate in the entertainment. The flag had been struck, and the gun had been fired at the right moment of time, and I felt as snugly cut off from the rest of Woolworth as if the moat were 30 feet wide by as many deep. Nothing disturbed the tranquillity of the castle but the occasional tumbling open of John and Miss Skiffins, which little doors were a prey to some spasmodic infirmity that made me sympathetically uncomfortable until I got used to it. I inferred from the methodical nature of Miss Skiffins' arrangements that she made tea there every Sunday night, and I rather suspected that a classic brooch she wore, representing the profile of an undesirable female with a very straight nose and a very new moon, was a piece of portable property that had been given her by Wemmick. We ate the whole of the toast and drank tea in proportion, and it was delightful to see how warm and greasy we all got after it. The aged especially might have passed for some clean old chief of a savage tribe, just oiled. After a short pause of repose, Miss Skiffins, in the absence of the little servant, who, it seemed, retired to the bosom of her family on Sunday afternoons, washed up the tea-things in a trifling, ladylike amateur manner that compromised none of us. Then she put on her gloves again, and we drew round the fire, and Wemmick said, "Now, aged parent, tip us the paper." Wemmick explained to me, while the aged got his spectacles out, that this was according to custom, and that it gave the old gentleman infinite satisfaction to read the news aloud. "I won't offer any apology," said Wemmick, "for he isn't capable of many pleasures. Are you, aged P?"
"All right, John, all right," returned the old man, seeing himself spoken to.
"Only tip him a nod every now and then when he looks off his paper," said Wemmick, "and he'll be as happy as a king." "We're all attention, aged one."
"All right, John, all right," returned the cheerful old man,
so busy and so pleased that it really was quite charming. The aged's reading reminded me of the classics at Mr. Wopsle's great aunt's, with the pleasanter peculiarity that it seemed to come through a keyhole. As he wanted the candles close to him, and as he was always on the verge of putting either his head or the newspaper into them, he required as much watching as a powder mill. But Wemmick was equally untiring and gentle in his vigilance, and the aged read on, quite unconscious of his many rescues. Whenever he looked at us, we all expressed the greatest interest and amazement, and nodded until he resumed again. As Wemmick and Miss Skiffins sat side by side, and as I sat in shadowy corner, I observed a slow and gradual elongation of Mr. Wemmick's mouth, powerfully suggestive of his slowly and gradually stealing his arm around Miss Skiffins' waist. In course of time, I saw his hand appear on the other side of Miss Skiffins, but at that moment Miss Skiffins neatly stopped him with the green glove, unwound his arm again as if it were an article of dress, and with the greatest deliberation laid it on the table before her. Miss Skiffins' composure while she did this was one of the most remarkable sights I have ever seen, and if I could have thought the act consistent with abstraction of mind, I should have deemed that Miss Skiffins performed it mechanically. By and by, I noticed Wemmick's arm beginning to disappear again, and gradually fading out of view. Shortly afterwards, his mouth began to widen again. After an interval of suspense on my part that was quite enthralling and almost painful, I saw his hand appear on the other side of Miss Skiffins. Instantly, Miss Skiffins stopped it with the neatness of a placid boxer, took off that girdle, or cestus, as before, and laid it on the table. Taking the table to represent the path of virtue, I am justified in stating that during the whole time of the aged's reading, Wemmick's arm was straying from the path of virtue and being recalled to it by Miss Skiffins. At last, the aged read himself into a light slumber. This was the time for Wemmick to produce a little kettle, a tray of glasses, and a black bottle with a porcelain top cork, representing some clerical dignity of a rubicund and social aspect. With the aid of these appliances, we all had something warm to drink, including the aged, who was soon awake again. Miss Skiffins mixed, and I observed that she and Wemmick drank out of one glass. Of course, I knew better than to offer to see Miss Skiffins home, and under the circumstances I thought I had best go first, which I did, taking a cordial leave of the aged and having passed a pleasant evening. Before a week was out, I received a note from Wemmick, dated Walworth, stating that he hoped he had made some advance in that matter appertaining to our private and personal capacities, and that he would be glad if I could come and see him again upon it. So I went out to Walworth again, and yet again, and yet again, and I saw him by appointment in the city several times, but never held any communication with him on the subjects in or near Little Britain. The upshot was that we found a worthy young merchant or shipping broker, not long established in business, who wanted intelligent help, and who wanted capital, and who, in due course of time and receipt, would want a partner. Between him and me, secret articles were signed, of which Herbert was the subject, and I paid him half of my £500 down, and engaged for sundry other payments, some to fall due at certain dates out of my income, some contingent on my coming into my property. Miss Skiffins' brother conducted the negotiation. Wemmick, pervaded it throughout, but never appeared in it. The whole business was so cleverly managed that Herbert had not the least suspicion of my hand being in it. I never shall forget the radiant face with which he came home one afternoon and told me, as a mighty piece of news, of his having fallen in with one Clarica, the young merchant's name, and of Clarica's having shown an extraordinary inclination towards him, and of his belief that the opening had come at last. Day by day, as his hopes grew stronger and his face brighter, he must have thought me a more and more affectionate friend, for I had the greatest difficulty in restraining my tears of triumph when I saw him so happy. At length, the thing being done, and that day he having entered Clarica's house, and he having talked to me for a whole evening in a flush of pleasure and success, I did really cry in good earnest when I went to bed, to think that my expectations had done some good to somebody. A great event in my life, the turning point of my life, now opens on my view. But before I proceed to narrate it, and before I pass on to all the changes it involved, I must give one chapter to Estella. It is not much to give to the theme that so long filled my heart. Chapter 38. If that staid old house near the green at Richmond should ever come to be haunted when I am dead, it will be haunted, surely, by my ghost. Oh, the many, many nights and days through which the unquiet spirit within me haunted that house when Estella lived there. Let my body be where it would, my spirit was always wandering, wandering, wandering about that house. The lady with whom Estella was placed, Mrs. Brandley by name, was a widow, with one daughter several years older than Estella. The mother looked young, and the daughter looked old. The mother's complexion was pink, and the daughter's was yellow. The mother set up for frivolity, and the daughter for theology. They were in what is called a good position, and visited and were visited by numbers of people. Little, if any, community of feeling subsisted between them and Estella, but the understanding was established that they were necessary to her and that she was necessary to them. Mrs. Brandley had been a friend of Miss Havisham's before the time of her seclusion. In Mrs. Brandley's house, and out of Mrs. Brandley's house, I suffered every kind and degree of torture that Estella could cause me. The nature of my relations with her, which placed me on terms of familiarity without placing me on terms of favour, conduced to my distraction. She made use of me to tease other admirers, and she turned the very familiarity between herself and me to the account of putting a constant slight on my devotion to her. If I had been her secretary, steward, half-brother, poor relation, if I had been a younger brother of her appointed husband, I could not have seemed to myself further from my hopes when I was nearest to her. The privilege of calling her by her name and hearing her call me by mine became, under the circumstances, an aggravation of my trials, and while I think it likely that it almost maddened her other lovers, I knew too certainly that it almost maddened me. She had admirers without end. No doubt my jealousy made an admirer of everyone who went near her, but there were more than enough of them without that. I saw her often at Richmond. I heard of her often in town, and I used often to take her and the Brandleys on the water. There were picnics, fete days, plays, operas, concerts, parties, all sorts of pleasures through which I pursued her, and they were all miseries to me. I never had one hour's happiness in her society, and yet my mind all round the 24 hours was harping on the happiness of having her with me unto death. Throughout this part of our intercourse, and it lasted, as will presently be seen, for what I then thought a long time, she habitually reverted to that tone which expressed that our association was forced upon us. There were other times when she would come to a sudden check in this tone, and in all her many tones, and would seem to pity me. "Pip, Pip," she said one evening, coming to such a check, when we sat apart at a darkening window of the house in Richmond. "Will you never take warning?"
"Of what?"
"Of me." "Warning not to be attracted by you, do you mean, Estella?"
"Do I mean? If you don't know what I mean, you are blind."
I should have replied that love was commonly reputed blind, but for the reason that I always was restrained, and this was not the least of my miseries, by a feeling that it was ungenerous to press myself upon her when she knew that she could not choose but obey Miss Havisham. My dread always was that this knowledge on her part laid me under a heavy disadvantage with her pride, and made me the subject of a rebellious struggle in her bosom. "At any rate," said I have no warning given me just now, for you wrote to me to come to you this time."
"That's true," said Estella, with a cold, careless smile that always chilled me.
After looking at the twilight without for a little while, she went on to say, "The time has come round when Miss Havisham wishes to have me for a day at Satis. You are to take me there, and bring me back, if you will. She would rather I did not travel alone, and objects to receiving my maid, for she has a sensitive horror of being talked of by such people. Can you take me?"
"Can I take you, Estella?"
"You can, then. The day after tomorrow, if you please. You are to pay all charges out of my purse. You hear the condition of your going."
"And must obey," said I.
This was all the preparation I received for that visit, or for others like it. Miss Havisham never wrote to me, nor had I ever so much as seen her handwriting. We went down on the next day but one, and we found her in the room where I had first beheld her, and it is needless to add that there was no change in Satis House. She was even more dreadfully fond of Estella than she had been when I last saw them together. I repeat the word advisedly, for there was something positively dreadful in the energy of her looks and embraces. She hung upon Estella's beauty, hung upon her words, hung upon her gestures, and sat mumbling her own trembling fingers while she looked at her, as though she were devouring the beautiful creature she had reared. From Estella she looked at me, with a searching glance that seemed to pry into my heart and probe its wounds.
"How does she use you, Pip? How does she use you?"
she asked me again, with her witch-like eagerness, even in Estella's hearing. But when we sat by her flickering fire at night, she was most weird. For then, keeping Estella's hand drawn through her arm and clutched in her own hand, she extorted from her, by dint of referring back to what Estella had told her in her regular letters, the names and conditions of the men whom she had fascinated. And as Miss Havisham dwelt upon this role with the intensity of a mind mortally hurt and diseased, she sat with her other hand on her crutch-stick, and her chin on that, and her wan, bright eyes glaring at me, a very spectre. I saw in this, wretched though it made me, and bitter the sense of dependence, even of degradation, that it awakened, I saw in this that Estella was set to wreak Miss Havisham's revenge on men, and that she was not to be given to me until she had gratified it for a term. I saw in this a reason for her being beforehand assigned to me. Sending her out to attract and torment and do mischief, Miss Havisham sent her with the malicious assurance that she was beyond the reach of all admirers, and that all who staked upon that cast were secured to lose. I saw in this that I, too, was tormented by a perversion of ingenuity, even while the prize was reserved for me. I saw in this the reason for my being starved off so long, and the reason for my late guardian's declining to commit herself to the formal knowledge of such a scheme. In a word, I saw in this Miss Havisham as I had her then and there before my eyes, and had always had her before my eyes. And I saw in this the distinct shadow of the darkened and unhealthy house in which her life was hidden from the sun. The candles that lighted that room of hers were placed in sconces on the wall. They were high from the ground, and they burnt with the steady dullness of artificial light in air that is seldom renewed. As I looked round at them, and at the pale gloom they made, and at the stopped clock, and at the withered articles of bridal dress upon the table and the ground, and at her own awful figure with its ghostly reflection thrown large by the fire upon the ceiling and the wall, I saw in everything the construction that my mind had come to, repeated and thrown back to me. My thoughts passed into the great room across the landing where the table was spread, and I saw it written, as it were, in the falls of the cobwebs from the centrepiece, in the crawlings of the spiders on the cloth, in the tracks of the mice as they betook their little quickened hearts behind the panels, and in the gropings and pausings of the beetles on the floor. It happened on the occasion of this visit that some sharp words arose between Estella and Miss Havisham. It was the first time I had ever seen them opposed. We were seated by the fire, as just now described, and Miss Havisham still had Estella's arm drawn through her own, and still clutched Estella's hand in hers, when Estella gradually began to detach herself. She had shown a proud impatience more than once before, and had rather endured that fierce affection than accepted or returned it.
"What?" said Miss Havisham, flashing her eyes upon her. "Are you tired of me?"
"Only a little tired of myself," replied Estella, disengaging her arm and moving to the great chimney-piece, where she stood looking down at the fire.
"Speak the truth, you ingrate!"
cried Miss Havisham, impatiently striking her stick upon the floor.
"You are tired of me!"
Estella looked at her with perfect composure, and again looked down at the fire. Her graceful figure and her beautiful face expressed a self-possessed indifference to the wild heat of the other that was almost cruel.
"You stock in stone!" exclaimed Miss Havisham. "You cold, cold heart!"
"What?" said Estella, preserving her attitude of indifference as she leaned against the great chimney-piece and only moving her eyes.
"Do you reproach me for being cold? You? Are you not?"
was the fierce retort.
"You should know," said Estella. "I am what you have made me. Take all the praise, take all the blame, take all the success, take all the failure, in short, take me." "Oh, look at her! Look at her!"
cried Miss Havisham bitterly.
"Look at her so hard and thankless on the hearth where she was reared, where I took her into this wretched breast when it was first bleeding from its stabs, and where I have lavished years of tenderness upon her."
"At least I was no party to the compact," said Estella, "for if I could walk and speak when it was made, it was as much as I could do. But what would you have? You've been very good to me, and I owe everything to you. What would you have?"
"Love,"
replied the other.
"You have it." "I have not,"
said Miss Havisham. "Mother by adoption," retorted Estella, never departing from the easy grace of her attitude, never raising her voice as the other did, never yielding either to anger or tenderness. "Mother by adoption, I have said that I owe everything to you. All I possess is freely yours. All that you have given me is at your command to have again. Beyond that, I have nothing, and if you ask me to give you what you never gave me, my gratitude and duty cannot do impossibilities."
"Did I never give her love?"
cried Miss Havisham, turning wildly to me.
"Did I never give her a burning love, inseparable from jealousy at all times, and from sharp pain, while she speaks thus to me? Let her call me mad! Let her call me mad!"
"Why should I call you mad?" returned Estella. "I, of all people. Does anyone live who knows what set purposes you have half as well as I do? Does anyone live who knows what a steady memory you have half as well as I do? I, who have sat on this same hearth on the little stool that is even now beside you there, learning your lessons and looking up into your face, when your face was strange and frightened me."
"Soon forgotten,"
moaned Miss Havisham.
"Time soon forgotten."
"No, not forgotten," retorted Estella. "Not forgotten, but treasured up in my memory. When have you found me false to your teaching? When have you found me unmindful of your lessons? When have you found me giving admission here," she touched her bosom with her hand, "to anything that you excluded? Be just to me."
"So proud, so proud,"
moaned Miss Havisham, pushing away her grey hair with both her hands.
"Who taught me to be proud?"
returned Estella. "Who praised me when I learnt my lesson?"
"So hard, so hard,"
moaned Miss Havisham with her former action.
"Who taught me to be hard?"
returned Estella. "Who praised me when I learnt my lesson?"
"But to be proud and hard to me!"
Miss Havisham quite shrieked as she stretched out her arms.
Estella! 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 To be proud and hard to me!
Estella looked at her for a moment with a kind of calm wonder, but was not otherwise disturbed. When the moment was past, she looked down at the fire again.
"I cannot think," said Estella, raising her eyes after a silence, "why you should be so unreasonable when I come to see you after a separation. I have never forgotten your wrongs and their causes. I have never been unfaithful to you or your schooling. I have never shown any weakness that I can charge myself with."
"Would it be weakness to return my love?" exclaimed Miss Havisham.
"But yes, yes, she would call it so." "I begin to think," said Estella, in a musing way, after another moment of calm wonder, "that I almost understand how this comes about. If you had brought up your adopted daughter wholly in the dark confinement of these rooms, and had never let her know that there was such a thing as the daylight, by which she has never once seen your face. If you had done that, and then for a purpose had wanted her to understand the daylight, and know all about it, you would have been disappointed and angry."
Miss Havisham, with her head in her hands, sat making a low moaning and swaying herself on her chair, but gave no answer.
"Or," said Estella, "which is a nearer case, if you had taught her from the dawn of her intelligence, with your utmost energy and might, that there was such a thing as daylight, but that it was made to be her enemy and destroyer, and she must always turn against it, for it had blighted you and would else blight her. If you had done this, and then for a purpose had wanted her to take naturally to the daylight, and she could not do it, you would have been disappointed and angry."
Miss Havisham sat listening, or it seemed so, for I could not see her face, but still made no answer.
"So," said Estella, "I must be taken as I have been made. The success is not mine, the failure is not mine, but the two together make me."
Miss Havisham had settled down, I hardly knew how, upon the floor, among the faded bridal relics with which it was strewn. I took advantage of the moment, I had sought one from the first, to leave the room, after beseeching Estella's attention to her, with a movement of my hand. When I left, Estella was yet standing by the great chimney-piece, just as she had stood throughout. Miss Havisham's grey hair was all adrift upon the ground among the other bridal wrecks, and was a miserable sight to see. It was with a depressed heart that I walked in the starlight for an hour and more, about the courtyard and about the brewery and about the ruined garden. When I at last took courage to return to the room, I found Estella sitting at Miss Havisham's knee, taking up some stitches in one of those old articles of dress that were dropping to pieces, and of which I have often been reminded since by the faded tatters of old banners that I have seen hanging up in cathedrals. Afterwards, Estella and I played cards, as of yore, only we were skilful now and played French games, and so the evening wore away, and I went to bed. I lay in that separate building across the courtyard. It was the first time I had ever lain down to rest in Satis House, and sleep refused to come near me. A thousand Miss Havishams haunted me. She was on this side of my pillow, and on that, at the head of the bed, at the foot, behind the half-open door of the dressing-room, in the dressing-room, in the room overhead, in the room beneath, everywhere. At last, when the night was slow to creep on towards 2 o'clock, I felt that I absolutely could no longer bear the place as a place to lie down in, and that I must get up. I therefore got up and put on my clothes and went out across the yard into the long stone passage, designing to gain the outer courtyard and walk there for the relief of my mind. But I was no sooner in the passage than I extinguished my candle, for I saw Miss Havisham going along it in a ghostly manner, making a low cry. I followed her at a distance, and saw her go up the staircase. She carried a bare candle in her hand, which she had probably taken from one of the sconces in her own room, and it was a most unearthly object by its light. Standing at the bottom of the staircase, I felt the mildewed air of the feast chamber, without seeing her open the door. I heard her walking there, and so across into her own room, and so across again into that, never ceasing the low cry. After a time, I tried in the dark both to get out and to go back, but I could do neither until some streaks of day strayed in and showed me where to lay my hands. During the whole interval, whenever I went to the bottom of the staircase, I heard her footsteps, saw her candle pass above, and heard her ceaseless low cry. Before we left next day, there was no revival of the difference between her and Estella, nor was it ever revived on any similar occasion, and there were four similar occasions, to the best of my remembrance. Nor did Miss Havisham's manner towards Estella in any wise change, except that I believed it to have something like fear infused among its former characteristics. It is impossible to turn this leaf of my life without putting Bentley Drummle's name upon it, or I would very gladly. On a certain occasion, when the Finches were assembled in force, and when good feeling was being promoted in the usual manner by nobody's agreeing with anybody else, the presiding Finch called the Grove to order, forasmuch as Mr. Drummle had not yet toasted a lady, which, according to the solemn constitution of the society, it was the brute's turn to do that day. I thought I saw him leer in an ugly way at me while the decanters were going round, but as there was no love lost between us, that might easily be. What was my indignant surprise when he called upon the company to pledge him to Estella?
Estella who? Said I.
Never you mind, retorted Drummle.
Estella of where? Said I. You are bound to say of where, which he was as a Finch.
Of Richmond, gentlemen, said Drummle, putting me out of the question, and a peerless beauty.
Much he knew about peerless beauties, a mean, miserable idiot, I whispered Herbert.
I know that lady,
said Herbert across the table, when the toast had been honoured.
Do you? Said Drummle.
And so do I added with a scarlet face.
Do you? Said Drummle. Oh, Lord!
This was the only retort, except glass or crockery, that the heavy creature was capable of making. But I became as highly incensed by it as if it had been barbed with wit, and I immediately rose in my place and said that I could not but regard it as being like the Honourable Finch's impudence to come down to that grove. We always talked about coming down to that grove as a neat parliamentary term of expression, down to that grove, proposing a lady of whom he knew nothing. Mr. Drummle, upon this, starting up, demanded to know what I meant by that. Whereupon I made him the extreme reply that I believed he knew where I was to be found. Whether it was possible in a Christian country to get on without blood after this was a question on which the Finches were divided. The debate upon it grew so lively, indeed, that at least six more honourable members told six more during the discussion that they believed they knew where they were to be found. However, it was decided at last, the Grove being a court of honour, that if Mr. Drummle would never bring so slight a certificate from the lady importing that he had the honour of her acquaintance, Mr. Pip must express his regret as a gentleman and a Finch for having been betrayed into a warmth which. Next day was appointed for the production, lest our honour should take cold from delay, and next day Drummle appeared with a polite little avowal in Estella's hand that she had had the honour of dancing with him several times. This left me no course but to regret that I had been betrayed into a warmth which, and on the whole to repudiate as untenable the idea that I was to be found anywhere. Drummle and I then sat snorting at one another for an hour, while the Grove engaged in indiscriminate contradiction, and finally the promotion of good feeling was declared to have gone ahead at an amazing rate. I tell this lightly, but it was no light thing to me, for I cannot adequately express what pain it gave me to think that Estella should show any favour to a contemptible, clumsy, sulky booby so very far below the average. To the present moment, I believe it to have been referable to some pure fire of generosity and disinterestedness in my love for her, that I could not endure the thought of her stooping to that hound. No doubt I should have been miserable whomsoever she had favoured, but a worthier object would have caused me a different kind and degree of distress. It was easy for me to find out, and I did soon find out, that Drummle had begun to follow her closely, and that she allowed him to do it. A little while, and he was always in pursuit of her, and he and I crossed one another every day. He held on in a dull, persistent way, and Estella held him on, now with encouragement, now with discouragement, now almost flattering him, now openly despising him, now knowing him very well, now scarcely remembering who he was. The spider, as Mr. Jaggers had called him, was used to lying in wait, however, and had the patience of his tribe. Added to that, he had a blockhead confidence in his money and in his family greatness, which sometimes did him good service, almost taking the place of concentration and determined purpose. So the spider, doggedly watching Estella, outwatched many brighter insects, and would often uncoil himself and drop at the right nick of time. At a certain assembly ball at Richmond, there used to be assembly balls at most places then, where Estella had outshone all other beauties, this blundering Drummle so hung about her, and with so much toleration on her part, that I resolved to speak to her concerning him. I took the next opportunity, which was when she was waiting for Mrs. Brandley to take her home, and was sitting apart among some flowers, ready to go. I was with her, for I almost always accompanied them to and from such places. "Are you tired, Estella?"
"Rather, Pip."
"You should be."
"Say rather I should not be, for I have my letter to Satis House to write before I go to sleep."
"Recounting tonight's triumph?" said I. "Surely a very poor one, Estella."
"What do you mean?" "I didn't know there had been any."
"Estella," said I, "do look at that fellow in the corner yonder, who is looking over here at us."
"Why should I look at him?" returned Estella, with her eyes on me instead. "What is there in that fellow in the corner yonder, to use your words, that I need to look at?"
"Indeed, that is the very question I want to ask you," said I, "for he has been hovering about you all night."
"Moths and all sorts of ugly creatures," replied Estella with a glance towards him, "hover about a lighted candle. Can the candle help it?"
"No," I returned, "but cannot the Estella help it?"
"Well," said she, laughing after a moment, "perhaps, yes, anything you like.
But Estella, do hear me speak. It makes me wretched that you should encourage a man so generally despised as Drummle. You know he is despised."
"Well," said she,
"you know he is as ungainly within as without, a deficient, ill-tempered, lowering, stupid fellow."
"Well," said she,
"well, you know he has nothing to recommend him but money and a ridiculous roll of addle-headed predecessors. Now, don't you?"
"Well," said she again, and each time she said it, she opened her lovely eyes the wider.
To overcome the difficulty of getting past that monosyllable, I took it from her, and said, repeating it with emphasis, "Well, then that is why it makes me wretched." Now, if I could have believed that she favoured Drummle with any idea of making me, wretched, I should have been in better heart about it. But in that habitual way of hers, she put me so entirely out of the question that I could believe nothing of the kind.
"Pip," said Estella, casting her glance over the room, "don't be foolish about its effect on you. It may have its effect on others, and it may be meant to have. It's not worth discussing."
"Yes, it is," said I, "because I cannot bear that people should say she throws away her graces and attractions on a mere boor, the lowest in the crowd."
"I can bear it," said Estella.
"Oh, don't be so proud, Estella, and so inflexible."
"Calls me proud and inflexible in this breath," said Estella, opening her hands, "and in his last breath, reproach me for stooping to a boor."
"There is no doubt you do," said I something hurriedly, "for I have seen you give him looks and smiles this very night, such as you never give to me."
"Do you want me, then," said Estella, turning suddenly with a fixed and serious, if not angry, look, "to deceive and entrap you?"
"Do you deceive and entrap him, Estella?"
"Yes, and many others. All of them but you. Here is Mrs. Brandley. I'll say no more."
And now that I have given the one chapter to the theme that so filled my heart and so often made it ache and ache again, I pass on, unhindered to the event that had impended over me longer yet, the event that had begun to be prepared for before I knew that the world held Estella,
and in the days when her baby intelligence was receiving its first distortions from Miss Havisham's wasting hands. In the Eastern story, the heavy slab that was to fall on the bed of state in the flush of conquest was slowly wrought out of the quarry. The tunnel for the rope to hold it in its place was slowly carried through the leagues of rock. The slab was slowly raised and fitted in the roof. The rope was rove to it and slowly taken through the miles of hollow to the great iron ring. All being made ready with much labour, and the hour come, the Sultan was aroused in the dead of the night, and the sharpened axe that was to sever the rope from the great iron ring was put into his hand. And he struck with it, and the rope parted and rushed away, and the ceiling fell. So in my case, all the work near and afar that tended to the end had been accomplished, and in an instant the blow was struck, and the roof of my stronghold dropped upon me. Chapter 39. I was 23 years of age. Not another word had I heard to enlighten me on the subject of my expectations, and my 23rd birthday was a week gone. We had left Barnard's Inn more than a year, and lived in the Temple. Our chambers were in Garden Court, down by the river. Mr. Pocket and I had for some time parted company as to our original relations, though we continued on the best terms. Notwithstanding my inability to settle to anything, which I hope arose out of the restless and incomplete tenure on which I held my means, I had a taste for reading, and read regularly so many hours a day. That matter of Herbert's was still progressing, and everything with me was as I have brought it down to the close of the last preceding chapter. Business had taken Herbert on a journey to Marseille. I was alone, and had a dull sense of being alone. Dispirited and anxious, long hoping that tomorrow or next week would clear my way, and long disappointed, I sadly missed the cheerful face and ready response of my friend. It was wretched weather, stormy and wet. Stormy and wet, mud, 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 deep in all the streets. Day after day, a vast heavy veil had been driving over London from the east, and it drove still, as if in the east there were an eternity of cloud and wind. So furious had been the gusts that high buildings in town had had the lead stripped off their roofs, and in the country trees had been torn up, and sails of windmills carried away, and gloomy accounts had come in from the coast of shipwreck and death. Violent blasts of rain had accompanied these rages of wind, and the day just closed, as I sat down to read, had been the worst of all. Alterations have been made in that part of the Temple since that time, and it is not now so lonely a character as it had then, nor is it so exposed to the river. We lived at the top of the last house, and the wind rushing up the river shook the house that night like discharges of cannon or breakings of a sea. When the rain came with it and dashed against the windows, I thought, raising my eyes to them as they rocked, that I might have fancied myself in a storm-beaten lighthouse. Occasionally the smoke came rolling down the chimney as though it could not bear to go out into such a night, and when I set the doors open and looked down the staircase lamps were blown out, and when I shaded my face with my hands and looked through the black windows, opening them ever so little was out of the question in the teeth of such wind and rain, I saw that the lamps in the court were blown out, and that the lamps on the bridge and the shores were shuddering, and that the coal fires in barges on the river were being carried away before the wind like red-hot splashes in the rain. I read with my watch upon the table, purposing to close my book at 11 o'clock. As I shut it, St. Paul's and all the many church clocks in the city, some leading, some accompanying, some following, struck that hour. The sound was curiously flawed by the wind, and I was listening and thinking how the wind assailed and tore it, when I heard a footstep on the stair. What nervous folly made me start and awfully connect it with the footsteps of my dead sister matters not. It was past in a moment, and I listened again and heard the footstep stumble in coming on. Remembering then that the staircase lights were blown out, I took up my reading lamp and went out to the stairhead. Whoever was below had stopped on seeing my lamp, for all was quiet. "There is someone down there, is there not?"
I called out, looking down.
Yes,
said a voice from the darkness beneath. What floor do you want?
The shop, Mr. Pip.
That is my name. There is nothing the matter.
Nothing the matter,
returned the voice, and the man came on. I stood with my lamp held out over the stair rail, and he came slowly within its light. It was a shaded lamp to shine upon a book, and its circle of light was very contracted, so that he was in it for a mere instant, and then out of it. In the instant, I had seen a face that was strange to me, looking up with an incomprehensible air of being touched and pleased by the sight of me. Moving the lamp as the man moved, I made out that he was substantially dressed, but roughly, like a voyager by sea, that he had long iron-grey hair, that his age was about 60, that he was a muscular man, strong on his legs, and that he was browned and hardened by exposure to weather. As he ascended the last stair or two, and the light of my lamp included us both, I saw with a stupid kind of amazement that he was holding out both his hands to me. "Pray, what is your business?" I asked him.
"My business?" he repeated, pausing. "Ah, yes. I will explain my business by your leave."
"Do you wish to come in?"
"Yes," he replied. "I wish to come in, master."
I had asked him the question inhospitably enough, for I resented the sort of bright and gratified recognition that still shone in his face. I resented it, because it seemed to imply that he expected me to respond to it. But I took him into the room I had just left, and having set the lamp on the table, asked him as civilly as I could to explain himself. He looked about him with the strangest air, an air of wondering pleasure, as if he had some part in the things he admired, and he pulled off a rough outer coat and his hat. Then I saw that his head was furrowed and bald, and that the long iron-grey hair grew only on its sides. But I saw nothing that in the least explained him. On the contrary, I saw him next moment once more holding out both his hands to me. "What do you mean?" said I, half suspecting him to be mad. He stopped in his looking at me, and slowly rubbed his right hand over his head.
"It's disappointing, dear man," he said in a coarse, broken voice. "Not having looked forward so distant and come so fur. You're not to blame for that. Neither on us is to blame for that. I'll speak in half a minute. Give me half a minute, please."
He sat down on a chair that stood before the fire and covered his forehead with his large, brown, venous hands. I looked at him attentively then and recoiled a little from him, but I did not know him.
"There's no one nigh," said he, looking over his shoulder. "Is there?"
"Why do you, a stranger coming into my rooms at this time of night, ask that question?" said I.
"You're a game one,"
he returned, shaking his head at me with a deliberate affection, at once most unintelligible and most exasperating.
"I'm glad you've grown up a game one, but don't catch hold of me. You'll be sorry afterwards to have done it."
I relinquished the intention he had detected, for I knew him. Even yet I could not recall a single feature, but I knew him. If the wind and the rain had driven away the intervening years, had scattered all the intervening objects, had swept us to the churchyard where we first stood face to face on such different levels, I could not have known my convict more distinctly than I knew him now, as he sat in the chair before the fire. No need to take a file from his pocket and show it to me. No need to take the handkerchief from his neck and twist it round his head. No need to hug himself with both his arms and take a shivering turn across the room, looking back at me for recognition. I knew him before he gave me one of those aids, though a moment before I had not been conscious of remotely suspecting his identity. He came back to where I stood, and again held out both his hands. Not knowing what to do, for in my astonishment I had lost my self-possession, I reluctantly gave him my hands. He grasped them heartily, raised them to his lips, kissed them, and still held them.
"You acted noble, my boy," said he. "Noble, Pip, and I have never forgot it."
At a change in his manner,
as if he were even going to embrace me, I laid a hand upon his breast and put him away.
"Stay," said I. "Keep off. If you are grateful to me for what I did when I was a little child, I hope you've shown your gratitude by mending your way of life. If you have come here to thank me, it was